Collins.
Your humble host, Peter B. Collins, with news and comment. It's Monday, August 10th, 2020. As many broke Americans face hunger, eviction, no health insurance in a pandemic, and no light at the end of any tunnel, Republican leaders are trying to use that suffering to blame Democrats and claim that they are poised and ready to help the average American. We are dealing with incredible levels of denial, denial of the seriousness of the plight of so many Americans, and projection, this weird political game where Republicans blame Democrats for the damage that they are doing, that they themselves are doing. And so we end up so detached from reality. And then Trump steps up and puts a crown on his head and signs four decrees at his golf club on Saturday, and pretends that he has fixed it all and sent the Democrats reeling. And he is so detached from reality that he must think that he can create it, you know, like he did on TV for too many years. And so as we look at the dire situation that faces so many people, and there is at least at the moment some decent news about the coronavirus pandemic, and we'll get to that shortly. I don't want to make it seem like it's great news, but we're seeing some declines in new cases and in hospitalization. But we've hardly turned a corner in any significant way. And the Republicans just turn up the noise. So you hear them say the Democrats want economic chaos in order to defeat Trump. And I have my problems with the so-called Heroes Act that the Democrats passed out of the House back in May. In particular, the money that would go to lobbyists. But they put out their plan, and it languished all summer long, until the Republicans felt they had no choice but to do something. So they come at these complex issues with one-third of the money proposed by the Democrats. And then they basically play a game that unless the Democrats capitulate and adopt the $1 trillion package of the Republicans, that they are obstructionists who want to hurt Americans and who, you know, are playing political games to up their score at the expense of American families. Bill Barr was on the Fox News box last night claiming that Black Lives Matter protesters are part of a lefty power grab. He has utter awareness of the depth of rage in this country, the justified rage that so many Americans feel. Then there's Steve Mnuchin, who blames Pelosi and Schumer for his own refusal to compromise. And he has exposed himself as an utter tool. He'll say anything, do anything that Trump tells him to. Then I got another one of those unsolicited tweets from the Trumpster this morning saying that Pelosi and Schumer wasted 4 weeks. The 4 weeks were wasted because the Republicans initially wouldn't meet, and when they did, they wouldn't make any movement. And one of the most glaring issues is the Democrats, I believe the number is $70 billion, that they want to put into increasing food availability through SNAP, the food stamp program, and other efforts. And the Republicans so far have only agreed to $250,000. I mean, that won't buy Wheaties for any significant number of people just for breakfast. And Trump claims that the Democrats are just holding out because they want bailout money for Democratic cities and states that are, in his view, failing badly. Well, let me tell you something, Trump, you ignorant asshole. The state of California went into 2020 with $41 billion banked. Various accounts, there's a rainy day fund, there's surplus. And we need help now because of the dramatic drop in revenues because of the pandemic-related shutdowns and because of the significant added expenses of dealing with coronavirus. And if you don't make cities and states not necessarily whole, but give them some relief, they have no choice but to cut services, lay people off. And that's what can really take us into a depression that could take years to recover from. And then I sometimes regret this, but I punched up Rush Limbaugh on the way to the secret studio this morning, and there he was wrapping it all up in one slam burger sandwich, saying that Democrats really don't want to help people. It's the Republicans who do. And their idea of helping people is to reduce the $600 federal addition to unemployment benefits to $400. And then, as we'll describe here, force the states to pay 25% of that out of money that they don't have. Or they say they can take it out of money the feds have already given the states, but that money is either spent or allocated for coronavirus testing, for the additional cost of trying to reopen schools. And so the Republicans are playing that kind of fuzzy math, the voodoo economics that George H.W. Bush so aptly described. Of course, he wasn't talking honestly, but the terminology works. So here's Trump. Pelosi and Schumer have chosen to hold this vital assistance hostage, he said at his golf club on Saturday as he dramatically signed these four meaningless executive orders. And so he says the Democrats inserted things unrelated to COVID into the relief package when he's the one who insisted on $10 billion for the Pentagon, which essentially is to recover the money he stole from Pentagon budgets to build his frickin' wall. In addition, he insisted on almost $2 billion to build a new FBI headquarters because he doesn't want that vacant land to be scooped up and have a competing hotel built on Pennsylvania Avenue. And so the sheer disingenuousness, the flat-out lies that are part of this denial and projection toxic cocktail are evident. But they just blithely keep blithering on. And you got Fox News to amplify it. You got Rush Limbaugh to endorse it. And Trump's idea of funding the unemployment benefits that he's so generously stealing from emergency relief money, disaster relief money that is set aside for hurricanes and wildfires. And I have a pretty good hunch we're going to need that money. And then the race is on to force Congress to restore the money that Trump has stolen once again. And the idea that state unemployment departments that have been unable to cope with the massive number of filings that they have received. And California is now in very bad shape. More than a million people haven't gotten an unemployment check in weeks. They're saying, well, you know, we're hoping to have this all sorted out by the end of September. So you throw a curveball in there to reduce the amounts and the state has to pay 25% of it. I'm sorry, these are inefficient agencies that are not going to be able to cope. And so Trump's idea of this money trickling down and reaching people in time to avoid evictions, foreclosures, the ugly choice, do I buy groceries or pay the health insurance bill? Do I sell my car in order to pay the rent? These are the real choices facing American families who tragically went into this year with less than $1,000 in savings. The paltry $1,200 check that some people got, the stuttering unemployment benefits that have helped some people. These are the most practical ways to put money in people's hands to prevent evictions, to help mom-and-pop landlords, as I've described here on many occasions. And then the stunner. Out of these four executive orders, the one that nobody really argues about is extending relief for student loan debtors. But Trump's eviction protection is sheer fantasy. It has no basis in law, and nobody is required to observe it. But the granddaddy in this package was that he wants to unilaterally cut the payroll tax for people who are working and making under $100,000. Now, I think it's fair to say that anybody who is working for anything over 50 grand right now is probably feeling pretty lucky that they're not in the unemployment line. They're not worried about buying groceries or just the fundamentals of life. And so a payroll tax cut would put $5, $10, maybe $25 a week more money into their check. But it's unclear whether they would have to pay it back when they file for taxes next April, whether some employers would actually deduct it because it's not clear when or if they will have to pay it back. And so Trump is stoking the very chaos that his minions blame on the Democrats. And Pelosi and Schumer have offered to shave the size of their package by reducing the period of time that it's effective for. So, for example, the HEROES Act proposes that unemployment benefits would run through the end of the year. And Pelosi and Schumer said, okay, we'll make it through the end of November. And similarly with other elements in their package. But beyond the fantasy of these executive orders is whether these are legal. I believe they are not. And whether anybody will pay attention to them. Now, if this is just a blast over the bow, and Congress falls in line and they do put a package together in the near future, Trump could easily withdraw these orders and just say, look, I made them do it. I'll take credit for whatever action comes from Capitol Hill. And so he thinks that he wins no matter what. And say what you will about Nancy Pelosi. I have many criticisms of the speaker myself. But I think she's showing incredible strength and negotiating skills with the bumbling fools who represent the White House and the Republican Party. And I think it's interesting because I'm looking at a clipping here from my San Francisco Chronicle from this morning's paper. And the headline reads, "Unconstitutional slop, Pelosi says of Trump's virus orders." And it's true that she said that about these executive orders. But she was quoting Republican Senator Ben Sasse. Where's he from? Nebraska? Idaho? One of those states. Both of them are correct. But The Associated Press and the editors of the Chronicle, whoever wrote that headline, apparently didn't know the origin of that comment. Then we have governors who are saying, wait a minute. Here's Cuomo of New York. The executive orders will not be a substitute for legislation. It's on shaky ground legally, but even to the extent that he's executed executive orders, they aren't going to meet the demand. He strongly criticized the plan that, again, was just imposed through these orders, making states responsible for 25% of the unemployment funding. He called that laughable, and he's correct. Ned Lamont, governor of Connecticut, a Democrat, said the proposal would cost Connecticut about $500 million by the end of the year. I could take that money from testing. I don't think that's a great idea. I could take that money from mass disinfecting for our schools. I don't think that's a great idea. In fact, I think the president's plan is not a great idea. Oh, and Sass, I can confirm, is of Nebraska, the senator. And he got shit-tweeted by Trump today for his unconstitutional slop remark. Trump said he is a Republican in name only who had gone rogue again. And that's how Trump keeps Republicans in line. And most of them are in line. At their own peril. I think many of them are getting nervous, recognizing the depth of suffering by so many Americans, and that they are not going to forget that between now and Election Day in November. I want to recommend a piece and thank Carl Howard for pointing my way to it. It's from my longtime source. I've talked to Juan Cole. He's a professor at the University of Michigan, and he runs a great website. He mostly talks about Middle East issues, but often broadens out. And in a commentary posted today, he said, Europeans are staring at the United States with unbelief as we head for 300,000 dead from COVID and an economy shrunk 33% last quarter. And that we just appear to be all right with that. And his headline reads, why did Americans become such wimps? Silence as Trump kills tens of thousands, destroys Social Security and the post office. Oh, and let me back up because I didn't complete my thought about the big kahuna in Trump's executive orders. It relates to the payroll tax cut and what that means for Social Security. And I stand by my remarks that this is a pittance in the pockets of people who are already working. But if he does succeed in getting reelected and keeping his latest threat to gut Social Security and Medicare, that just is something that so many Americans, even Republicans, cannot even contemplate. And as somebody who gets a partial Social Security check right now, and I'll get a bigger one in a couple of years, I, of course, am dead set against to any damage to Social Security because I've worked all my life. I have a contract. I have paid into it. And he just wants to walk away from that. So back to Juan Cole. Not only are we perfectly willing to toss Grandma in an early grave on Trump's say-so, but we are supine as he openly engineers the destruction of Social Security and Medicare, the post office, on behalf of himself and the billionaire class he represents. That is after we sat by while he completely gutted all environmental regulations that got in the way of corporations making money off poisoning us. I don't think the neutering of the EPA has even been reported on daytime cable news. He says, we have become wimps. The word wimp may come from whimper. It was used in a newspaper in 1920 and then not again until 1960. And then it may have been influenced by the character of Wimpy in the Popeye cartoons. The character who was only good at mooching off people in search of a hamburger. And Cole goes back to the Reagan era, when the retirement age was raised and Americans yawned. But last year, when France, under President Macron, tried to raise the retirement age there from 62 to 64, all hell broke loose. 30 unions went on strike. They supported each other. Trains were stopped. Trucking was interrupted. Life was interrupted. 1 million people came out in the streets. And Macron backed off. But maybe it's because the French believed Macron was serious, and Americans can't tell if Trump will really follow through on these threats. But Cole closes his comment with, if the increasingly wimpy Americans don't watch out, they will find that it is too late to fight back, since they have surrendered all their means to do so. So as to avoid being panty wastes and all, they will be left with a borrowed greasy cheeseburger they can't even pay for. That's the wimpy joke. Well, the summer of rage continues, and Trump and Bill Barr, most Republicans are so out of touch. It's easy to point a finger at Chicago and just say, well, you know, that's a situation that's been out of control for far too long. But after police shot an armed black man on the South Side Sunday afternoon, hundreds of people converged on the glittering strip of Michigan Avenue called the Magnificent Mile. And I used to work on Michigan Avenue, just below the bridge over the Chicago River. All the bridges were raised yesterday to try to make it more difficult for these crowds that turned into, at least in some cases, a mob. There was significant looting of retail shops along Michigan Avenue. Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who had closed down a lakeside park on, Saturday. Today she said, we're waking up in shock. What occurred downtown and its surrounding communities was abject criminal behavior, pure and simple. So the police superintendent, David Brown, said police officers exchanged gunfire with a man who was holed up in an alley on the South Side, miles from the scene of the looting on Michigan Avenue. He's described as a 20-year-old man, not identified. He was injured but is expected to survive. But tempers flared, according to the police chief, the superintendent, fueled by misinformation as the afternoon turned into evening, and that grew and grew in the late night hours. Over 100 people were arrested, and it led to a transit partial shutdown that was restored earlier today. Meanwhile, Portland had its 74th consecutive night of Black Lives Matter demonstrations, and they have moved away from the federal presence at the Hatfield Courthouse downtown. Once again, their targets were the police officers' union headquarters. 16 were arrested outside that facility in North Portland. And once again, a handful of provocateurs managed to start a small fire in the lobby of the Police Association headquarters. Then at 8 p.m., people gathered in Kenton Park, marched to that union headquarters, gathered outside the building. And police declared a riot shortly after 10 p.m. Now, this is going to come up in our next story, but I believe the Portland police have been too quick to use the term riot, because the descriptions of these protests, with a handful of people who are trying to start fires, who are tossing fireworks or water bottles at the cops, I think that the police are overreacting. Saturday night in the same area, it was mostly peaceful until a small group lit a fire inside the police union building, which was quickly extinguished. Further north in Seattle, the city has agreed that a court order will bar police from targeting journalists, legal observers, and medics during protests. The city has also agreed that the order will bar police from using the declaration of a riot as a justification for indiscriminate force at protests. Seattle made these concessions in an agreement filed jointly Monday with lawyers for protesters who are suing the city for allegedly allowing the police to use unnecessary violence in controlling and suppressing crowds. As part of the deal, the lawyers will drop a request that the judge in the case hold the city in contempt of court. These could make the restrictions for crowd control by Seattle police the most rigid in the country, and they'll be in effect until a different federal judge decides whether the city council's ban on crowd weapons can take effect. And this kind of ping-pong between two federal judges has led to the one who presides over the prior consent decree with the Justice Department to be much more lenient and to actually overrule actions by the council, which are pretty clearly undemocratic. Monday's order is arguably, quote, the most comprehensive in the country, protecting journalists, legal observers, and medics from police abuses during protests, said David Perez, a lawyer for the plaintiffs in this case. Separately, the council is set to vote tonight on a resolution condemning the targeting of journalists, legal observers, and medics at protests. The resolution also seeks to get the city attorney's office to stop pursuing a subpoena of unpublished video and photos recorded by several news outlets at a protest. And I fully support that. I think it is an unlawful incursion into the rights of media outlets. And listener Paul Leto, who helps keep me updated on the scene in Seattle, sent a couple of notes. He said on Sunday the right-wingers took their chance to make a flash in the pan, he says. An evangelical pastor went to the former CHOP at Cal Anderson Park and preached revival to a couple of hundred mostly unmasked suburbanites in a message described as highly erotic. Wow, that's very exciting. And in downtown Seattle, a pro-police demonstration attracted a small counter-protest. The Seattle Times captured most of the action except for the live stream part, where a woman from the pro-police side started shoving counter-protesters and the police did nothing. Shocking, isn't it? On Friday, there was a bizarre scene in New York City where police used helicopters, police vans, dozens of cops to surround the home of a prominent Black Lives Matter protester. They wanted to pick him up for attempting to make, They were attempting to make an apprehension, claiming that he's a suspect in an assault on a police officer. The man they sought is Derek Ingram. Officers banged on his door, said that they had a warrant. When he asked to see it, they said, we can't find it. And from the Legal Aid Society, a lawyer who is not representing Derek Ingram said, this is very clearly a political decision by the police department to harass peaceful protesters without a legal means to do so. This is exactly what everyone in New York City should be worried about. Ingram, age 28, has been involved with Warriors in the Garden since June. He wrote, on Friday evening, this was an attempt to silence our movement. This militarized police response endangers the safety of residents in Hell's Kitchen and across NYC. Officers used threats and intimidation tactics on a young man with no criminal history. And to his credit, he live-streamed the incident for hours on Instagram on Friday, and Instagram did not block his video feed. And the cops tried to act reasonable. One who banged on his door said, Derek, you're the one making this difficult. We're just trying to get you to come outside. You're the one being hostile. And he responded, I'm not being hostile. I'm calm. So when Ingram asked to see that warrant, the officers didn't produce one. They hung around for more than 5 hours. And then they left. Chalk one up for the progressive side. Meanwhile, in Beirut, the protests there, and they're not wimpy, the Lebanese, have led to a mass resignation. The prime minister and members of his cabinet resigned today, opening up a new political void as the country struggles with the economic crisis and reels from that mega blast. Prime Minister Hassan Diab, who's only been in office since January, said he and his ministers had sought to put in place changes, but found themselves blocked at every turn by political foes. "They are the true tragedy of the Lebanese people," he said of the country's other politicians. "We're going to step back to stand with the people to wage the battle for change with them." So already some members of his 20-member cabinet had resigned. At least 7 members of the 128-seat parliament have resigned. Diab will continue in a caretaker capacity with President Michel Aoun designated to choose a new prime minister. And Diab is an engineering professor, a former minister of education. He came to office with the backing of Hezbollah. And so the protesters can claim a partial victory here. But, of course, it doesn't resolve the complex, long-running problems there. And over the weekend, Pepe Escobar filed a dispatch for Asia Times, and he acknowledged to people like me on his email list, he said, "I had to leave out 2 literally explosive pieces of intelligence because publishing them now would set the whole house literally on fire." Nevertheless, he said, "In Lebanon, we find that negligence and corruption may have been fully exploited via sabotage to engineer what he sees as efforts at regime change." He said, "Lebanon is a multinational den of spies of all shades, House of Saud agents, Zionist operatives, moderate rebel weaponizers, Hezbollah intellectuals, debauched Arab royalty, self-glorified smugglers. In a context full of full-spectrum economic disaster, afflicting a member of the Axis of Resistance." He refers to Trump's comment on Tuesday, according to his generals, they would know better than I, but they seem to think it was an attack, a bomb of some kind. And Pepe asks, "Was this incandescent remark letting the cat out of the bag by revealing classified information, or was the president launching another non sequitur?" And he says that an Iranian news agency reports that 4 U.S. Navy reconnaissance planes were spotted near Beirut at the time of the blasts. That's a new development, to my knowledge. He goes through the history that we've covered before about the origins of the 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate. He says that neither the prime minister nor the president or any cabinet ministers knew that the ammonium nitrate was stored in Hangar 12, according to a former Iranian diplomat. And Pepe describes it as a massive IED placed mid-city. "The bureaucracy at Beirut's port," he says, "and the mafias who are actually in charge are closely linked to the Al-Mustaqbal faction, which is led by former Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, himself fully backed by Saudi Arabia. The immensely corrupt Hariri was removed from power last October amid serious protests. He and his cronies disappeared at least $20 billion from Lebanon's treasury, which has seriously aggravated the current economic crisis." He says, "No wonder the current government, where we have Prime Minister Diab backed by Hezbollah, had not been informed about the ammonium nitrate." And he says, "So far, the prime straight-to-the-point explanation by Middle East expert Elijah Manier points to the tragedy being sparked by a clueless blacksmith with a blowtorch operating quite close to the unsecured ammonium nitrate. This scenario, though, does not explain the initial fireworks explosion, and certainly does not explain what no one, at least in the West, is talking about: the deliberate fire set to an Iranian market in Ajam in the United Arab Emirates, and also to a series of food/agricultural warehouses in Najaf, Iraq, immediately after the Beirut tragedy. And again, this is a dot that I was not previously aware of, that Pepe is connecting. Then he talks about the opportunity for predatory capitalists to get into Beirut, which has a lot of value. Then he writes, "Once again, Israel is the proverbial elephant in a room now widely depicted by Western corporate media as Lebanon's Chernobyl." He said, "A scenario like the Beirut catastrophe has been linked to Israeli plans since February of 2016. Israel did admit that Hangar 12 was not a Hezbollah weapons storage unit. Yet, crucially, on the same day of the blast, and following a series of suspicious explosions in Iran and high tension on the Syria-Israeli border, Netanyahu tweeted, in the present tense, 'We hit a cell, and now we hit the dispatchers. We will do what is necessary in order to defend ourselves. I suggest to all of them, including Hezbollah, to consider this.'" And Escobar notes, "That ties in with the intent openly proclaimed late last week to bomb Lebanese infrastructure if Hezbollah harms Israeli Defense Forces soldiers or Israeli civilians." A couple of paragraphs down, he says, "It must be stressed that a Saudi intel source, whose stock in trade is frequent information exchanges with Mossad, asserts that the original target was Hezbollah missiles stored in Beirut's port. His story is that Netanyahu was about to take credit for the strike, following up on his tweet. But then Mossad realized the op had turned horribly wrong and metastasized into a major catastrophe." So, I value the perspectives of Pepe Escobar, and I trust his reporting based on his own sources. Shifting to Hong Kong, where the U.S. announced new sanctions on its chief executive Carrie Lam and 10 other senior officials last Friday. Hong Kong government denounces it as blatant and barbaric interference in China's domestic political situation. The new sanctions are the first against officials in Hong Kong and mainland China over the city's harsh suppression of pro-democracy protests, which continue today as publisher Jimmy Lai, a wealthy Hong Kong citizen who owns media outlets including Apple Daily, well, he was arrested. So were two of his sons. And then more than 200 cops arrived at the offices of the Apple Daily newspaper for a show of force, and they rifled through desks there. Since the new security law took effect, the Hong Kong authorities have arrested people for T-shirts, tweets that were seen as advocating independence from China. They've asserted a right to prosecute critics abroad. They've barred 12 pro-democracy candidates from legislative elections and postponed those elections by a year. Interesting report under the byline of Max Blumenthal, publishing today at the Gray Zone Project. And he reveals that an American man with ties to Amnesty International and key Hong Kong separatist figures has been posing online as a Hong Kong native named Kong Sung Gan. Routinely cited as a grassroots activist and writer by major media organizations and published in English-language media, the fictitious character Kong appears to have been concocted to disseminate anti-China propaganda behind the cover of Yellowface. And they go into great detail about the tweeting and the other commentary of this avatar, Kong Sung Gan, and they reveal that this is the alter ego, if you will, of an American whose name is Brian Patrick Kern. He's been a fixture at the Hong Kong protests since they erupted in 2019, and he's been widely quoted in media outside Hong Kong, including here in the United States. Also, in an expose of what she says are fake videos used to promote the Beijing government's brutal treatment of Uyghurs in the far west Xinjiang province of China. Well, Caitlin Johnstone does not quibble that Uyghurs are being mistreated or that they are sent to re-education camps. But she notes that the odious right-wing influencer Ian Miles Chiong recently posted a video of a man being brutalized by an unseen tormentor, which he captioned Chinese communism. And it turns out the video footage was falsely described as being that of the persecution of a Uyghur Muslim. Because, Johnstone says, it's not from China, and the man being tormented is not a Uyghur Muslim. And then she looks at some other postings, including one shared by the account Uyghur Genocide on Twitter, captioned, China has been keeping a world record in techniques to torture prisoners and detainees. But the footage that is labeled that way is a BDSM fetish video from Taiwan, where people posed in a prison-like setting and played at torture games. And again, she is saying just be aware of misinformation. She is not asserting that the persecution of Uyghurs is a false meme. There's another piece that Johnstone published, and she is so prolific. I think she writes almost every day now. And it relates to the announcement on Friday that not only is Russia trying to meddle in the 2020 election, but also China, and Iran. She writes, the press release from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence claims that Russia wants Trump to win re-election and is pushing to advance that goal, while China and Iran are doing the same with Joe Biden. And Johnstone says, what this completely unsubstantiated narrative means, of course, is that no matter who wins in November, America's opaque government agencies will have already primed the nation for more dangerous escalations against countries which have resisted being absorbed into the blob of the U.S. centralized empire. If Trump wins, we can expect his administration to continue its escalations against Russia in retaliation for 2020 election interference. And if Biden wins, we can expect his cabinet of Obama administration holdovers to ramp up escalations against China in the same way, while Joe mumbles to himself off to the side as his brain turns to chowder. And then she says, there's never a legitimate reason to believe any unproven claim made by unaccountable spook agencies about U.S. targeted governments. But even if everything in this press release were true, it's an incredibly stupid thing to care about. The influence that Russia, China, or Iran could exert over public opinion in the United States is a tiny fraction of that which is exerted by the unaccountable U.S. billionaire media every single day, which already has its own factions pushing for Biden over Trump and Trump over Biden. Adding some foreign social media operations into the mix would change literally nothing. And I agree with Katie Johnstone. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Marvin Rasmussen, Robert Hoff and his wife Andrea, Paul Karsh, and Joe Carson. They each chip in $5 or $10 a month. You could do it too. They set a standard for you to try to live up to. Just check in at peterbcollins.com/signup. And the options are right there for you to consider. Another great piece of investigative journalism published at the Gray Zone Project today, this by Ben Norton. And it relates to Twitter. Twitter has made a claim that they do not publish state-affiliated media accounts as advertising on Twitter. And Norton follows that up with a declarative sentence, "This is categorically false." And then what he shows is that American-affiliated media spend a lot of money on Twitter. The Voice of America, its Persian language arm, VOA Farsi. And he says, that means that a U.S. state-affiliated media outlet published more than 60 individual ads on Twitter in a mere 7 days, the same week when Twitter reaffirmed its ban on ads from state-affiliated media outlets. The United States doesn't count in the view of Jack Dorsey and the gang over at Twitter. Maybe you heard over the weekend Twitter is getting into a bidding war with Microsoft to try to engage in Trump piracy to take over TikTok, or at least its American operations. And I do believe this is an act of piracy. Trump has issued an order banning TikTok and WeChat 45 days from last week, unless his threats are honored. He wants TikTok sold to an American company, and some portion of the purchase price goes into the U.S. Treasury. That is extortion, clear and simple. But it starts with an act of privacy, forcing a Chinese company to sell itself if it wants to operate in the United States. And what if China did that to Facebook? They say, hey, Zuck, we haven't let you operate in China, but we will. All you have to do is sell it to a designated Chinese company. And they're going to take part of that money and put it into the Beijing treasury. We would be aghast and all that kind of stuff. So at The Intercept today, reporter Mara Vistendahl reports that while she can't get any confirmation that the owners of TikTok share information with the Chinese government, she does have proof based on documents leaked to BlueLeaks. These documents reveal the two representatives of ByteDance registered on the website of the Northern California Regional Intelligence Center. That's a fusion center that covers Silicon Valley. TikTok collects and hands over information that is similar to the way that Amazon, Facebook, and Google regularly cooperate. The documents show that the FBI and Homeland Security actively monitor TikTok for signs of unrest, and they did so during the George Floyd protests. During the last half of last year, TikTok received 100 requests covering 107 accounts. It handed over information in 82% of cases. Facebook received 51,000 requests, and they handed over at least some data in 88% of cases. TikTok handed over multiple IP addresses, information about the devices used to register for accounts, cell phone numbers, and unique IDs to the U.S. government. Once again, projection, right? Because Trump is saying that China does what we do. And that is somehow unacceptable. Over in the former Soviet Republic of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko claims that he was reelected to a sixth term on Sunday with 80% of the vote. This is widely reviewed as heavily rigged, but he is snuffing out any opposition. Tension escalated sharply Sunday evening after a police truck rammed into a crowd of protesters in the capital of Minsk. They had barricaded the avenue with metal dumpsters, but they were dispersed by squads of riot police officers. There was an opponent named Sergei Tikhanovsky. He's a popular blogger and a would-be presidential candidate, but he was arrested and thrown into jail just before the election, so his wife stepped up, Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Hope I have that name right. I see. He's Tikhanovsky and she's Tikhanovskaya. Yeah, I've seen that before. They have gendered naming conventions in Russian. Anyway, she went into hiding in Minsk after security agents detained at least 8 members of her campaign staff. And there is a guy who's an American on the scene in Minsk. His name is Vitaly Shklyarov. Okay, something like that. And he was detained and charged for organizing an illegal political rally for Ms. Tikhanovskaya. He's a 44-year-old Belarusian citizen who is the spouse of a U.S. diplomat, holds an American diplomatic passport. More than 1,300 people have been detained there in Belarus. They say that Shklyarov is responsible for organizing a May 29 event in the western Belarusian city of Grodno, where Sergei, who was still free at that point, was collecting signatures for his wife to run for president. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. As of today, we're closing in on 20 million worldwide confirmed cases, with a total death toll reported at 732,000. In the United States, we crossed the 5 million number of confirmed cases, as deaths ticked up to 163,000. And yesterday, this could be a lag in reporting of data, but there were only 530-some reported deaths nationwide. In the past 2 weeks, it's been over 1,000. It's hit 1,300 on several days. So according to The Guardian, the U.S. death toll fell 16% to 7,200 last week, the first decline after 4 weeks of increases. We posted more than 376,000 new cases for the week ending August 9th, or about 53,000 per day. New cases have fallen for 3 straight weeks. If you recall, we did hit 60 and 70,000 in recent weeks. New cases in Arizona fell by more than 48% in the past week. And on the 9th of August, the state reported fewer than 1,000 cases for the first time since the end of June. And nationally, we are holding steady about an 8% positive rate on all of the people who get tested for COVID-19. The big shift is that the number of cases among children rose 40% in the last 2 weeks of July. From the American Academy of Pediatrics, 338,000 children tested positive since the onset of the epidemic, 97,000 new cases reported between July 16th and 30th. Most of the new infections occurred in the South and West, and this is based on data from 49 states. Out of almost 5 million reported cases in the U.S., more than 338,000 are children, and 25 died of the coronavirus in July alone. Pressure to get kids back into the classroom has left superintendents in more than 13,000 school districts trying to figure out how to keep kids safe. We're also learning, in terms of the shifting demographics here, I have some numbers in California, and of course we do have to offer the caveat that we believe that we have restored the missing data due to the computer glitch that troubled the California data collection all of last week. But I can't be 100% sure of that. So in 6 Bay Area counties, 18 to 40-year-olds represent 48% of all cases. Statewide, the number of cases among people 18 to 34 shot up by 1,358% between May 1 and August 1, from 12,000 to 180,000, representing an increase from 24% of all cases to 35%. And during the same period, the number of cases among people 65 and older grew far more slowly. So it is a significant shift. There's another issue that surfaced in a weekend report at the New York Times about super spreaders. So a new study, which has not been peer-reviewed, so it's preliminary, suggests that between 10 and 20% of coronavirus cases seed 80% of new infections, and that the riskiest window for transmission may be a period as short as 1 or 2 days in the week or so after a person is infected. And, of course, with the delays in getting test results to people, we are driving blind in a snowstorm in way too many cases. And as we head into fall, what they call the onset of indoor weather, we could be in for more difficulty. According to Michael Osterholm at the University of Minnesota, with the K-12 school year resuming in some parts of the country or set to start, along with universities in a few weeks, transmission will take off and cases will start to climb again. He predicted the next peaks will exceed by far the peak we have just experienced. Winter is only going to reinforce that indoor air. It's possible that some remedies may be developed by then. But meanwhile, he says, pandemic-weary Americans seem more interested in resuming pre-COVID lifestyles than in suppressing the virus to the point where schools can be reopened and stay open, and restaurants, movie theaters, and gyms can function with some restrictions. Adding to the gloomy comments is epidemiologist Michael Mina from Harvard. We just continue to squander every bit of opportunity we get with this epidemic to get it under control. The bright spot, of course, is New Zealand, which has had a COVID-19, 100 days have passed since they had cases identified via community transmission. As of Monday, the total count in New Zealand is 1,219 confirmed cases, and just 21 are considered to be active infections, which are being managed in isolation facilities. Back on March 23, New Zealand imposed a nationwide lockdown, and it had only 28 confirmed cases at the time. The restrictions were lifted on June 8th with no positives found in roughly 40,000 tests. And Greece is emerging as a next possible hotspot for coronavirus transmission. Linda also has additional data on what I opened with today, the threat of eviction that many people are facing. Almost a third of American households, 32%, have not made their full housing payments for July yet, and it's the 10th of August. Renters, low-income, and younger households were the most likely to miss their payments, according to Apartment List. In Denver, the homeless shelters are starting to see an increase in people showing up. They're showing about 1,700 visitors a night now, and informal encampments are popping up. And from the Atlantic magazine, Matthew Desimond, the author of Evicted, writes, an eviction can be extremely unsettling, with a family's most personal effects, clothes, furniture, kids' toys, piled on street corners, or hastily packed into trucks or cars. But while spectators may soon forget those disturbing scenes, an eviction can haunt a tenant and their family for years. The psychological, legal, and financial damage inflicted by the process makes it difficult to find new housing, keep a job, or provide stable education for children. And as rents climb in many American cities, evictions are becoming more and more commonplace. Well, Trump has decided that maybe he wants to have a historic Gettysburg address. He insists he still may give his Republican National Committee or convention acceptance speech at the White House, but that is illegal. It's a violation of the Hatch Act. He knows it. But of course, for Big Don the Con, the rules don't apply. But even Mark Meadows, his bulldog chief of staff, expressed disapproval for the idea of using the White House, and Trump has floated Gettysburg National Military Park in Pennsylvania, but similarly, that is federal property, And the Hatch Act prohibits federal employees from engaging in political activities while they're on the job. So are they going to bring in non-union, non-government workers to run the event? And, of course, Trump wants a crowd with no masks. So I don't know. In a lot of ways, I don't care. But I do care about his wanting to violate the law to use federal property as a prop for his speech. The Democrats have announced parts of their lineup for next week's Zoom convention. Bernie Sanders gets to speak on Sunday night along with renegade Republican, former Governor John Kasich of Ohio. Hillary Clinton will deliver a primetime speech on Wednesday. I can't wait for that. Bill Clinton is going to give a speech, but we're not told yet when. Joe Biden will accept the nomination from Delaware, and the location has yet to be announced. Michelle Obama has been working on her speech. They think that's going to be, it's not clear when, but she's been working at it at her summer mansion on Martha's Vineyard, so you know it's going to be great. I'm very happy to report to you that Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who tried to relaunch his political career, has been rejected by the voters of Maricopa County in a too close election. It never should have been that close, but the results have eliminated him from the Republican primary. And finally, today, voters in Puerto Rico went to the polls on Sunday to participate in primary elections. But at many locations, they were unable to vote because there weren't any ballots. And apparently, there were truckloads of ballots in San Juan, but they didn't get delivered to polling places across the island. It's a stinky way of suppressing the vote. And maybe we'll find out who's responsible. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You can share it all over the dang place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.